When you're communicating, when you're educating people about diversity and inclusion, what do you think is the idea that's the hardest to get people to wrap their hands around and grasp? What's the thing that, like, is your personal hardest struggle when you're trying, when you're like, okay, I have to talk to you about this. You try it, you give it your best shot, you know you just missed, right? You set it up well.
Yeah.
You knew that they, you felt like they were ready. What's that thing where you're feeling like there's just disconnect?
I think there's a couple, but I think that the main one is the notion of equity.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with equity.
Mm-hmm.
I think people struggle with the notion of equity.
Mm-hmm.
They understand equality.
Mm-hmm.
Their notion of equality, okay, everything's equal.
Mm-hmm.
Although some folks don't read the fine print when it comes to equal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does equal mean?
What does equal mean? But equity is the biggest thing. And I generally explain it as triage or assistance, filling in gaps for people. You know, I have illustrations and what have you. I can show them. I can give them analogies about, you know, let me give you an example. I was speaking at a local prep school, and the notion of equity came up. And so these are privileged, very well-educated kids.
Mm-hmm.
And teenagers. And I got to equity. I showed an image of four individuals. It's a fairly popular image. And they're looking over a fence.
Yeah, that's my favorite example. Right.
So one of them is just standing there. He's tall and lanky, he's looking over the fence.
Mm-hmm.
One of them needs a box to stand on to look over the fence, right? And just to abbreviate this, I said, you know, equity is providing the box to stand on for the shortest one,
mm-hmm.
so that they can leave. It's not a handout necessarily. It's taking into account their own limitations and struggles, and giving them the mechanism or creating a mechanism that helps bring about parity by mm-hmm. implementing equity. And one of the little kids said, "Well, that's not fair." And I said, what do you mean it's not fair? Well, everybody doesn't have a box. Why did she get a box?
Yeah.
And I said, well, the others don't need a box.
Mm-hmm.
They can just look over by themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not fair. She's getting a helping hand. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. If this was you and your mm-hmm. family were the people in this picture, you were at a baseball game
mm-hmm.
and you had a younger brother or sister that was five
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to see the game, but everybody else could just look over the fence.
Mm-hmm.
To see the game, what would you do? Well, I'd pick them up and hold them so they could look over the game. I said, that's equity.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you're willing, you're primed, and you are wired
mm-hmm.
to understand equity for yourself and the people you love and care about.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not wired to see equity for others.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that really fast. You wouldn't even think about it. You just pick mm-hmm. them up.
You know.
You know, because you love that person. That person's part of your family. You want to even things up. You want them to be able to participate, right? You're not seeing for them, right? You're just giving them, So just kind of, I said, think about it in those terms,
mm-hmm.
you know, equity. Think about it in those terms. Equity, for instance, is, let me give you another, when I first got my first professorship, somebody was going on and on about, oh, you make a lot of money now, you make a lot of money. And I said, well, yeah, but I'm not taking a home all that much
mm-hmm.
In comparison to my colleagues, particularly my white colleagues. Oh, that's reverse racist, they said.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting paid more than them. And I said, not really.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an equitable situation because, A, every black student on this campus comes to me.
Mm-hmm.
Something. So I'm a counselor, I'm a psychologist, I'm a conflict resolution specialist. I've gone to jails and bailed people out. That's not in my salary.
Yeah.
You know, I've paid for students to eat mm-hmm. because that's my community. They depend mm-hmm. upon me to do that. People say, well, you didn't have to do that. Well, my community teaches me that I have to do that because they're my community. And mm-hmm. I made it here to be able to help them.
And what they don't know too, Doc, is that like if it was the white kid, it's not like you would have held it.
I would have helped
you know
him
what
too.
I mean? But they don't But I think they connect it with like black to black and that yeah, right. it's just a black thing. And I'm like, no, it's not a black
no,
thing.
No, and white kids came to me too.
Right.
Because they felt like the other professors were just there to teach them in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so equity would have been me being compensated for that extra money mm-hmm. that I'm shelling out. And I was. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I made that money. Mm-hmm. Because I also divvied up to my family members. Mm-hmm. So when one of us makes it, mm-hmm. people of color, we generally share mm-hmm. and are compelled to in our culture mm-hmm. with others. So mm-hmm. we're not taking home all of that money. We don't even see all of that money mm-hmm. as ours just to do with whatever, invest it, go buy Coca-Cola stock, and go buy right. a cabin in the woods and all of that stuff. No, that's not the way that we think.
Yeah.
But we are taught from an early age without knowing what the term equity is to the think concept. In terms of the concept of equity. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think too, one of the things I wish we got better at communicating to poor white people was, and communities have that, especially smaller communities in rural spaces, they understand this idea more because right. there's no way they'd allow the family next door to starve if they knew that was happening. They'd still go take the food, right? Because that exists because they're still living in community.
Community.
Right? But the fear that's used against them is the concern that they won't be able to provide for themselves. Well, if you live in a community, you don't have to provide just for yourself because other people are willing to share the extra that they got.
I live in the middle of a very white, upper-class Mormon community, and they are some of the most generous people I've ever met in my life. And I love them dearly. Mm-hmm. But I'm the only black person in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So black people aren't really... I'm benefiting mm-hmm. from their generosity.
And they're not going to black spaces.
But they're not going to black spaces. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not mad at them because of that. But that's the next challenge and that's the next step. They're not in contact with them. Mm-hmm. So that capital is being spread from white family to white family. But they don't see themselves...
And Mormon to Mormon.
And Mormon to Mormon. Yeah. But they're not seeing themselves as being white necessarily. They mm-hmm. do identify as Mormon. And mm-hmm. they're doing that very strategically and tactically. Mm-hmm. But they don't see themselves as leaving anybody out.
Right.
And that's where we have to think a little bit more differently. But yeah, I help white kids too. Yeah. I mean, I that's just the way that we work.
Well, how could you not do it, right? You know, if you're going to do it in this one space, it's just ridiculous not to do it in another.
No, I never asked any questions. I didn't, you know, I just...
You just recognize need.
You need help, you need help, yeah. You know?
Yeah, that image that you were talking about with the boxes, I've seen another version of it where they change the fence to a chain link fence,
yeah.
where they talk about the systemic barrier is eliminated now and there's not this need for boxes anyway. Right. And like that's the go-to space. I've tried to use it as like, you know, if your dog craps in the living room and it's time to clean the house, you're not gonna start dusting. You know, you go to where the need is, right? You pick up the poop. Because you concentrate the efforts on the area of most need.
Most need. I've talked, equity is the term. I also use the term triage. Mm-hmm. Because let me tell you, Americans understand war.
Yeah.
The most successful history courses that always make are war.
Right.
And people get eerily excited about it. They come into class and it's just like, we get to World War II and it's and I'm thinking, oh, you know, what did Yoda say? War's not making one great, right? That's what I want to tell people. But they understand that, they understand triage because I'll say to them, if you're in a battlefield and somebody stubs their toe and it's cut and they're bleeding and you go and they take them into the triage place and then they bring in somebody that's hemorrhaging from the neck. Who do you think they're going to treat first? Right. They're going to treat the person hemorrhaging from the neck. Not because they want the person's toe to hurt, but you got somebody bleeding out from the neck.
Right.
Well, there are people, communities, and individuals bleeding out from the neck in our society. And what we're saying is, oh, well, we just got to be, everybody's got to be equal. Mm-hmm. I don't see color. I don't see class. I don't see this. That's not equity. That's not triage. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. What's the doctor going to say? Okay, we have to treat both patients simultaneously, you know,
and equitably.
So we only got one doctor. So we're going to roll them up between the two, and one he's going to use the right arm to service the one, and the left arm to service the other. No, come on, that's not even practical.
Right.
But that's the way we fixed our minds to make us feel as though everybody's getting equal treatment.
No. Yeah, that's one thing I put in here too, and it's the idea that, like, you know, somebody finding value in something or somebody else doesn't have anything to do with you. It just means maybe they've never had the value truly seen, and we need to uncover that because your value is no threat to mine.
Right.
And two, when we both recognize and see each other about that value, we then pair and we just both come together and move upward. And that's just the natural state of things. Like seeing and understanding things systemically is so...
Yeah, you have to. Let me tell you, if I have a flood in my house and my neighbor four houses down, their house is burning down, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be like, hey, I can't help you because I got water in my house. I mean,
the water damage is really bad.
Right. You know, water damage is bad. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, you know, and I got a problem. I'm not saying that I don't have a problem, but my goodness, we live in a desert. Phoenix, this is all made out of wood. Like, your house is going to be burned down in like minutes.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like, you know, I'm going to stay down here and keep tightening these screws on this pipe. I mean, come on, man. I mean,
the funny thing about your analogy is, too, the biggest areas of concern now are flooding and drought. And it's funny because I'm like, I don't understand that there's a problem. I see that we need to work on pipes.
My pipes.
Right? Because the problem is the system's out of balance. And too much of one thing is bad and too little of one thing is bad. And so that's where we need to concentrate on that equity concept.
Yeah.
And if we just saw that. And just because, you know, we're piping out so much water and we're not seeing anything in return from the drought place. Well, maybe not yet. It takes some time. Relax, just give and know you have the value. Right. And you were drowning in that water anyway. Let it go. Like, it was killing you. I think that's really interesting. So, on the flip side of that, what idea do you think that's a difficult one to communicate? Do you think you have a special gift in communicating? What one that's, you know, traditionally seen as a difficult thing to communicate, do you think you have the ability to explain particularly well, or you think you might have a, you know, a gift or whatever in that area?
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question.
Of course.
I think
well, give me a time to think, because I sort of have a little bit of an answer to it, and it gives you time to think, too.
Oh.
One of the things I'm working on is owning my privilege hard. So I can be, like, you know, I get the male privilege. Like, I'll tell stories about, like, a young female student was talking about, like, undoing the patriarchy, and I was like, oh, interesting. I was a little worried about that. I'm like, I know better than worry about, like, the patriarchy being undone, but, like, if I'm gonna be really real with myself, I did have that flinch moment where I'm like, uh-oh. Like, you know, I'm working on that. That's a thing for me. Like, that's a thing that I'm trying to undo. That's why I want to do that other series on positive masculinity, is because when you see masculinity, it's only in one way. I think we need to find a way of taking the best of it and showing people how to use the best of it, because we don't see what that looks like.
No, you're right. And that really helps me, because I think my biggest gift is my style. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, because I think I can push people without alienating them.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody can do that.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of what I think I'm really good at is explaining difference, particularly differences of race and sexuality, in ways that really disarm and bring people in. And I think that's because of my background. I grew up around so many different people that I think I can help people be at ease.
Yeah, your background particularly.
Yeah, I'm not only confronting it, but talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have that background, but I'm not judgmental with people who have fears and apprehensions. I'm just not. Because I also grew up in a very Christian family. Mm-hmm. I have people who are very... There were Orthodox Muslims as well. So my mom was very different in that she was what we now... my mom is what we now understand to be a pansexual.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, everybody just called her gay. But even then, back, she told me that didn't really capture who she was. But I grew up in a family where it wasn't easy for her to be who she was.
In an age.
Yeah. I mean... And she was an educator. You know, this was in an era where they felt like,
In Arizona,
where you're not going to be around my kids. You're going to indoctrinate them or use them in some sort of way, which is nonsense. So we had two addresses. We had two phones. We drove across town to shop in stores so we would make sure that nobody that we knew was in the community would see them. And so I understand what it's like to be othered and, like, closeted. And it ain't a good feeling. And I try to communicate that to people that, hey, your beliefs, you're entitled to them, but they manifest themselves in interactions and politics and religious pageantry and ceremony and rites, and that affects people. And so you really got to think about what you're doing and what you're saying, because at the end of the day, you're just dealing with people.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with people, and I often tell them, you have no idea how many people you interact with on a daily basis on the spectrum of sexuality.
Yeah.
Is somewhere from in between here to here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just here or here. You guys think it's no.
Right. Yeah.
You just, because I grew up in it, so I know how dynamic it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're living in a dream world,
right,
of heteronormativity, where you think everybody is 100% straight, mm-hmm, or most people are 100% straight. It mm-hmm doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can communicate that to people. It doesn't mean they're going to abdicate their concerns, but they need to know,
mm-hmm,
the world is larger than what you think.
Yeah.
And even if it isn't, those people have people that they love, like me,
mm-hmm,
that are an extension of them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you factor those allies and loved ones in, that's a large community.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things that I've been given that I can. And I also, well, you know what? I think, actually, I would say this. I think I can help people think the way jazz music sounds. Or at least, no, you know what? Everybody does it.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, well, thank you. But I think,
I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if we're going to explain it well, but like, I know who the feeling you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think most people think the way jazz music sounds. They just don't realize it, or they don't allow themselves to do it. And that's extemporaneous. They put their thoughts and experiences into boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really how human beings are wired.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are truly at our best, our creative genius, when we have multiple sounds playing individual tunes that come together extemporaneously to make one.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what jazz does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the highest form of our being and creativity. Mm-hmm. We just need to allow ourselves to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we got all these conventions that hold us back.
The saxophone's more important than the piano.
That's what I'm saying, right? You know, the saxophone, is this one is going to drown out this instrument. But no.
It's a give and take. It's a back and forth, right? So it's the piano's time. It's the saxophone's time. It's how that works.
Look.
And it's negotiated without talking.
It's
to
right.
create the beauty that exists in it.
Miles Davis, Coltrane, they're just genius. Dizzy Gillespie, when you listen to the music, it's just, it's rap music borrows a lot from jazz,
mm-hmm,
in terms of its extemporaneous nature,
mm-hmm,
which is one of the reasons why I think Generation X and after embrace it so much,
mm-hmm,
because we are more in tune with the extemporaneous nature and diversity of our thought.
Mm-hmm.
We're the Apple generation and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
We're Google. I mean, we're constantly thinking and processing things. And it's remarkable. I would love to look into the future and see human endeavors 1,000 years from now.
Yeah.
Because I think we'll get past a lot of this stuff, especially when we start embracing the fact that we're jazz, we think. And our brains, mm-hmm, are wired like jazz.
Yeah.
Not Beethoven's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Classical, quote unquote, music can be. Beethoven's fifth is beautiful. Like I've often said, it's, you know, Beethoven's fifth is the same notes played at different octaves over and over, and it's sublime. It's gorgeous, mm-hmm, but it's linear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that he was a linear thinker,
mm-hmm,
but he created a sublime linear sound.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not linear. Human beings are not linear.
Well, and I think too, even with Beethoven, you have to look, right? Because I don't know that. Do you think he was thinking linear when he thought about all his pieces together?
Oh,
no. You know what I mean? Like, when you think of the music of Beethoven, yeah, he had pieces. But those pieces, I imagine there's a Beethoven playlist that you can connect that has that.
Oh, without a doubt. That's what I'm saying.
Circular...
He was asymmetrical thinker. That's what made him such genius. He was able to create the fifth.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to single that out.
Yeah.
With such precision, but still go back and think the way that he was thinking. We gotta let ourselves think and act that way, and just be able to roll with a little more. Other disciplines can help us, science and other ones. I mean, you know, just the notion of sight.
Well, and I think one of the other benefits I get out of this so much is that I can think differently about things. And when you give me a problem, I can come up with atypical answers because I'm looking at the world in a way that most people don't as much. it'll be really interesting to see what you come up with your book on the masculinity stuff. I'll have to bring you out for that stuff too, just because, I mean, there's some good stuff in it, but it's not what gets reproduced.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting. My goal in the book is to convey the ways in which I've used the unique culture in which I was raised to survive in a society that constantly is throwing stuff at you. Mm-hmm. So it's a story of struggle, but it's a story of overcoming that struggle using that struggle itself and the tools that my culture has given me to fight them, to show other young men that there isn't one way of being a man. And I'm speaking specifically to boys and men, and even more specifically to young black ones, because when I was growing up, it was be uber athletic. You got to dance a certain way. You got to rap a certain way. You got to carry yourself a certain way. And it was all very backward.
Prescribed.
And all very prescribed. Yeah. It was, and I wasn't most of that.
Right. But you're trying to be the thing.
I was trying to be, but I wasn't most of that. Right. I didn't like getting dirty. I didn't like bugs. Right. I liked sewing. I liked playing with Barbie dolls. Right. I mean, Barbie was a boss. Barbie had a summer house. She had a pool. She had a Corvette. But I want to. G.I. Joe had bombs. G.I. Joe blew stuff up. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of linear. You know what I'm saying?
Well, he's a tiny box of a person.
He's
right?
A tiny
There's
box
Marine
of a person.
There's Marine G.I. Joe. There's Navy G.I.
Yeah.
Joe. I mean, he's not.
Listen. He might have had some quote unquote cool guns and what have you, but I would rather go kick him out of pool with a dream convertible.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Or get in the RV with the bathroom in it, what have you. I mean,
right.
So I just wasn't feeling any of that stuff. I liked to cook. I didn't start doing quote unquote typical manly things until I was in high school, and when I did, women taught me to do it.
Well, and I think it's somebody showing you the opportunity to difference in a way you hadn't been told. When someone explained pansexuality as they had the ability to love any human, I was like, oh, I'm limited by my heterosexuality to just some people. Like, it just blew my mind.
My mom told me when I was younger, before I looked up the definition of pansexuality, I asked her, she said, if she was gay or lesbian, and she said, no, I don't consider myself that. Mm-hmm. Which really freaked me out, because back then you had one or the other,
right?
You know, and I was like, well, she's like, babe, I'm attracted to confidence, I'm attracted to intelligence, I'm attracted to a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I'm not attracted to a person.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and that kind of helped me mm-hmm. understand.
Well, we need that so much. I mean, I don't know about you, speaking from my own personal experience, I can't tell you how many like really attractive train wrecks I've dated over my life in an effort to boost my shallow esteem with some pretty person that wasn't that great of a human. No, I mean, I'm not going to forever damn this person for being who they were in that moment, but it's because I was trying to find, like, looks over quality person.
Right.
And so much pain and sorrow and hurt. And now to be able to say I have the partner that I have now, that's just like an amazing, beautiful person that pushes me to a better person, that is better than me in a lot of amazing things. Oh, I wish somebody would have told me about that when I was younger.
Because men put a lot of pressure on ourselves and a lot of pressure on everybody else, but we do. Yeah. I had a lot of men come to my office over the years as a professor, young men who struggle with the burden of perfection.
Yeah.
Or the burden of providing and this and that. And you know, there were times when I would say, well, can your partner contribute? Or and the thought hadn't even occurred to them.
Right.
Or they thought that there was something lacking in them that their partner would have to contribute. And I would joke and say, you didn't grow up in my mom's house. Like, my mom said, she never really wanted anything from a man. Like, mm-hmm. she wanted things to be equal, mm-hmm. you know, and just struggling with all kinds of stuff. I had white men, young white men come to my office all the time who liked the young Latino or black girl, but were afraid to ask them out because they didn't want to be rejected because they were white, or they didn't want to be ostracized by other white people. I mean, this notion that being a man, particularly a white man, is it's easy in some respect. I mean, it's there's privilege in some respects, but there's an overwhelming burden in other respects that nobody can live up to. And that's what's so coercive about it, because it's teaching these boys, they're developing all sorts of complexes because
it's impossible.
Yeah, it's just impossible. No matter what, it's impossible. And so I say to them, listen, you do know that you do not have to be, you do not have to be the best everywhere you go in the room that you're in. And you're not going to be.
Like, and I tell you, shouldn't
try to be. You should try to be. You're not going to be the strongest.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to pull all the nicest looking white women in every room that you go to.
Yeah.
You're not going to control whatever board you're on.
Yeah, I agree. I think as men, there's a long way to go. So I'm going to be really excited to hear what you have to say. And, and two, we'll find a space where we can have that conversation in that other forum too.
I would love it.
So you've been living this this diversity inclusive life for a while now, and it's cost you, right? It's cost you. It's cost your family.
yeah.
I don't know that people are aware that it costs and that it costs so much.
Yeah.
So I'd want to have you kind of share your thoughts, like, about that and what that experience has been like.
It's been hard, and there's no way to sugarcoat it. And I can't say that I wasn't warned. I just didn't fully grasp what was meant by those who warned me. My advisor that I mentioned earlier, Darlene Clark Hine, my doctoral advisor, told me once in response to a question that I posed to her, I said, if you have one piece of advice to give me now that I go out into the world as this quote-unquote scholar, academic, whatever you want to call it, what would that be? And she said, understand that this life is as political as it is intellectual. And I didn't know what that meant. I thought I knew what it meant. I thought I meant there would be some jostling over ideas, maybe some competition over space, intellectual space, physical space, some turf battles over, you know, some academic things, ethnic studies, things of that nature. But she was referring to a much broader spectrum of potentialities that I didn't grasp until later. And when you do this work and you're good at it and you're a person of color, you are a target from day one. And you're a target in ways that you can't possibly imagine when you first get started. Because the work, even if you're not a social media person, it's public work.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have a Facebook page or a Twitter account, if you're out doing forums, if you're out working with community, people are going to know you. They're going to know where you're going, when you're going, what you're going to talk about, who you're talking to. And all of those things individually together might threaten somebody else. You're going to be lobbying elected officials. You're going to be pushing elected officials. You might be working with and serving elected officials. They're all very political. And the people who follow them are very political. Money interests, people across the ideological spectrum, people who don't want to see certain changes happen. And so before you know it, when you do this work, you realize that white supremacists are watching you, neo-Nazis are watching you, businesses who have certain issues and stakes in certain political measures are watching you. The educators are watching you. Colleagues are watching you who don't want to see you advance or don't like your politics, but use weaknesses in your work against you so that you cannot go out and advocate for certain things. When you get on the, when you get on the radio, people are going to listen. They're going to look you up. They're going to. So I've had all sorts of things. I've had people show up at events where I've been to speak to that want to do harm. I've had death threats. I've had threats on the family. I've had people show up at the house. I've had media show up at the house that have been sicked on me by people who wanted, you know, sort of an unflattering place for me. I've had my work hyper scrutinized. I've made mistakes in the past. Everybody makes mistakes. Those mistakes are then magnified. One of my favorite great aunts when I was younger said, she used to call me Mr. Big because she said, you know, you can be Mr. Big, I can tell, right? And in fact, when she said, when you become Mr. Big, get one of those personalized plates. And I got a personalized license plate when I first started working.
Yeah.
And people thought I did it because I was being vainglorious. But yeah. My great aunt was the first person who said, you got to get one of those plates. Because in her mind, people who made it had quote-unquote yeah. vanity plates.
Yeah.
And so I did it for her. But they didn't know the background.
Right.
And I had people complaining about that.
Yeah.
Complaining about how much I made. You know, if you go out and do consulting, they find out you're consulting, and they go out, they don't like that, so they plant negative stories with people you're working with. You name it.
Yeah.
It's happened. And everybody that I know that's done this work has had something similar happen. Mm-hmm. And they usually come after your family first, your name, and then your pocketbook. Mm-hmm. And they're all sort of tethered. Mm-hmm. You know, who are you seeing? You know, who was your partner? Mm-hmm. My wife is white. So, you know, people might say, man, you're just a glutton for punishment, you know, mm-hmm. but there are people who don't want that.
Yeah.
Even some people who pretend to be inclusive don't want that.
Yeah.
And so there are consequences, and those consequences sometimes cost you tens of thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. if not more, legal fees.
Yeah.
You got to protect yourself and your name to pay for these sort of things. We've lost cars, we've lost, you know, money we've set aside. So there is a cost doing this work. But it's still worth it, because you don't get into it for the material stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I was doing this when I was in high school. I helped found the Black Student Union at my high school. I would mm-hmm. pay to do that.
Yeah.
You know, we took over the dances and diversified that. We integrated the music and started playing hip hop and R&B at my dances. And
yeah.
you know, I marched in the King holiday protest downtown when I was in 13 and 14 years old, and mm-hmm. I wasn't paid as an undergraduate to do this sort of stuff. So I'd be doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And I can't see myself doing any, because there's nothing more rewarding. And Martin Luther King said it best. First of all, Malcolm X said, the ultimate price of freedom is death. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to be morbid, but that's his litmus test.
Yeah.
So if you're not willing to give your life
yeah.
for what you believe is important, then King said, you're not worthy of it.
Yeah.
You're just not. And so your life is the most important thing. So what is a car?
Yeah.
You know, what is some money? And that's what people think they can get you with. That's why I'm a Star Wars fan. Yoda's yeah. just brilliant.
Yeah.
Right? So Yoda says you got to be willing to part with that which you value the most. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't, that's what people will use against you. Mm-hmm. So the minute you fall too much in love with notoriety or material things, they'll think that they can hammer you with that. But that's not why I do it. I do it because you see the light go on in somebody's face. Mm-hmm. You see people come together. When I wrote my first book, there's a story in it, because it's a biography of two civil rights leaders in Phoenix who were just remarkable people. Mm-hmm. And they touched so many different lives. And I got a phone call one day, my apartment. And I don't know how they got my number, but I picked it up, and it was a lady, an older lady. Mm-hmm. And she was sobbing through the whole conversation. She said, I read your book, mm-hmm. and I have to tell you that it means so much to me that you wrote it. Because when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. and a little girl, she said, the subject of my book moved in next to her in Paradise Valley in a big mansion. Mm-hmm. And she said, me and my mom went next door to welcome them. And my dad ran out of the house and ran over yelling and cursing and calling them the N-word and what have you, and grabbed us and made us go back into our house. Mm-hmm. And she said, that family didn't get angry or anything. They just sort of, you know, shut the door. Mm-hmm. They continued to wave at her. And when she got older, she would talk to them, and they were very nice and supportive. And she wanted to thank them, but she was never able to do that. So mm-hmm. she wanted to know if I could put her in contact with their children. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, let me call them and see. Well, their children remembered that incident yeah. and that little girl. And I was able to connect them, and they went out and had dinner, and they've still been in contact ever since. Yeah. You know, how can that happen yeah. without this type of work? I mean, if I don't do anything else in my life, that alone was worth it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This woman yeah. carried that guilt for decades until yeah. she was able to sit down with the Ragsdale son
yeah.
and say, this really harmed me. I felt really bad about it. And it taught me to be unlike my dad. Mm-hmm. So you can't put a price tag on that, man. Yeah. That's two lives, I think. One that was redeemed mm-hmm. and one that was soothed and affirmed mm-hmm. because of something like that.
Yeah.
So I tell people who want to do this work, you're never going to make enough There's not enough money in the world to equal the good feeling that's going to come out of doing it, because you're helping people, you're helping humanity. And that's what drives. And the real people will continue to work with you and support you. So I have not had a cessation in activity throughout all of these different things that I've gone through, mm-hmm. particularly among communities of activists and the communities that I work for, mm-hmm. because many of them, they know the deal.
Yeah.
You know, Martin Luther King was called a philanderer and a plagiarist and a narcissist and a megalomaniac and a usurper, and he was called a traitor and a treasonist. And I'm not comparing myself to Martin Luther King, but the reality is that it doesn't matter who you are. Mm-hmm. If you do this work, somebody's going to find something on you to attack you with. And some of it may be true. It's not, you know, Martin Luther King did cheat on his wife.
Yeah.
But Martin Luther King was a great man. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King gave his life for the struggle. Mm-hmm. People in the community did really, this may sound rough, but his personal life was between him and Coretta. Mm-hmm. They were following him because he was a great civil rights leader and a human rights activist. They knew he was a man and they knew he was human. Mm-hmm. They didn't approve of it, mm-hmm. but that's why they continued to embrace him. And Coretta Scott King knew that. When the FBI called her and threatened to leak everything, she said, go ahead.
It's not like she didn't already know.
I already know. In the community, meeting people in the community know. And you think they're going to stop following him because of this?
Right.
You know, no, you have a problem.
If it would have been an issue, that would have been his undoing at the moment.
Right. Yeah. She says, that's all you got?
Well, and I kind of like it too, because one of my favorite thing about reading scripture is like everybody's flawed. You know what I mean? And it's their humanity in spite of all that stuff.
Right.
You know, like, look at Moses, like he's killing people, like yelling at folks and throwing stuff around. Jesus flipping tables.
Peter was a pretty angry guy too.
Oh yeah.
But
their humanity keeps them accessible.
Right.
And shows that we're all capable of that type of
greatness. And the struggles for me have been my test, because you know, the question is, how committed are you?
Yeah.
So there have been times where I've thought about folding up my tent and just going and studying my books and writing, mm-hmm. and living a very obscure life like Walt Whitman in the wild or something.
Yeah.
But that's not my anointing. That's not that. Yeah. That's not.
It'd be a waste.
That ship has sailed, and so I got to embrace it and know that there's always going to be a storm.
Yeah.
You know, there's never not going to be. I was blessed that I lived 40 years with. Out having major storms.
Yeah.
The death threats and all that type of stuff. I've been getting that stuff since I was in high school. When you deal with white supremacy, you're going to get that. You know, most of them are cowards. And it's not that they're not capable of doing bad things, but the vast majority of them are just talking as cowards. Mm-hmm. It's the professional undermining that I didn't anticipate in the attacking one's family. I'm a very altruistic person, and I just would never do that to people.
Yeah.
And so it's
hard. You can't see the attack coming.
I can't. You can't see it, particularly people who know you.
Yeah.
No, that's the thing. Who will flip. So, to people who do this work, it's worth it. Whatever comes, you'll survive it. You'll get past it. You may have to make some adjustments, but that's what life is about. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, that's the reason why I wanted to create this podcast. One, because I need to get my thoughts in order. Because I do feel like this is
important.
This is the new form of personal leadership. That's not about you. It's about us, but it's still about you. And it's unexamined because it's not popular.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's that idea that I'm looking to communicate, which is why you had to be one of the first people that I talked to. Because I mean, like, you know, the ups and downs and the backwards and forths of it, you've kind of been there and lived through it all. But I mean, I know you know that. So the last question that I have for you is, historians can be the best fortune tellers, best predictors of the future, because, you know, it always rhymes, right? So
most historians hate that. They would never admit that it's true, but they don't, because they don't want that responsibility.
Right. Well, but
if they're not going to take the,
then what good are you doing for us anymore? All you did is wrote stuff down.
Like,
like if you're not doing, like, you got to do something. Like, knowing something and not doing anything with it is the most useless thing in the world. It's It's a waste.
Well, and I was taught to say, I used to say that to people when I first started. I know you got to ask you a question, but
yeah.
I was, when I first started being, you know, I wanted to be the writer, historian. So people ask me questions about the future. And I said, well, you know, we're not prognosticators and we can't say this and that, the other thing. And I had an older black person say to me, so we mean we bled out and spent all that money and marched all those years so you can go and get this PhD to educate us and to work for us. And that's your response is you don't. She said, well, if you can't, who can?
Yeah.
She, what's your purpose then? What right. You know? And I was like, she said, no. She said, I don't want you to tell me what to do. I don't want you to tell me what's going to happen. Given your knowledge, I want you to tell me what is possible.
Exactly.
And if you can't tell me what's possible based upon historical precedent, then you're kind of useless to me. She literally said that to me, like broke me down. And I was like, oh, she said, you're not out at the university right now. You're here in a community, and we there aren't a whole lot of you.
Yeah.
So we need you to, and I said, oh, okay. Well, mm-hmm. Let me tell you then, you know? And so, I mean, to answer your question, I mean, I think if you were going to ask me.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you see is, within the next 2-3 years, what are the big, you know, that you know of? That you feel relatively confident with. I mean, no one can tell the
future. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you wouldn't want to know if you knew.
No, I think we are in, a watershed moment. Mm-hmm. We were at a fork in the road last year.
Yeah.
And we made a turn.
Yes, we did.
And so now the question is, how are we going to negotiate that turn? And I think there's going to be a period of exasperation and frustration that's going to be upon us, especially for progressive people, especially for diversity and inclusion people. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a really bright light afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I'm encouraging people to hunker down, mm-hmm. understand that change happens daily. Mm-hmm. So we got to get to work right now, and we got to get our ducks in a row. Mm-hmm. And if you are a progressive person, be progressive. Mm-hmm. If you support D&I, do it in every shape and form, everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. You can't let up. You can't back down. You mm-hmm. can't retreat. Now's the time to double down. Some people might think now's the time to back off a little bit. No. Now's the time where you really have to double down, mm-hmm. because we're going to see some historical challenges to a lot of stuff we worked for.
Yeah.
And if we turn over 40 years worth of work is going to be undone. Mm-hmm. And that may seem like a sky is falling type of prognosis, mm-hmm. but it's not. But I believe we'll rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. These things are cyclical. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that we'll rise.
People aren't aware of that.
Yeah. They're cyclical. We'll rise to the occasion. We'll be wiser. And then we will realize that there are certain things we can't fall asleep at the wheel over. And there are certain things we have to value because it's harder to, they can be snatched away in an instant, mm-hmm. even if it takes 100 years to get them. Mm-hmm. And that's what folks don't really grasp.
Yeah.
So I'm uplifted. I think that this millennial generation is a remarkable one. Mm-hmm. They're often criticized for being narcissistic and it's the me generation. And they are in many ways.
Yeah.
But previous generations, we had our baggage too.
Yeah.
So I'm not here to, you know, throw shade on millennial generations. What I love about them is their fearlessness. Mm-hmm. And I think that the older generation has to be able to suppress our desire to control them and to just help them when asked to channel that fearlessness and mm-hmm. intelligence and creativity into leading us into that new path. Mm-hmm. I'll say this and I'll stop. I listened to an interview on NPR. Oh, this was years ago. And somebody said that the United States will not take a significant turn for the better socially until that 60s generation stops fighting and dominating everything. Mm-hmm. Stops dominating political discourse, stops mm-hmm. dominating social discourse. So right now we've had Generation X, Y, Z, millennials battering that. That 60s is so big and mm-hmm. so powerful and so entrenched. Think about it.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, 60s generation, still going at it.
Yeah.
And so they said, until they stop or we take their dominance away, mm-hmm. we're still going to be dealing with that same baggage that they bring, even the progressive element of it. So millennials are our best hope. You know, I just we got to support them as much as we can. You know, and we also have to be stronger without becoming nasty. We got to get stronger.
When they go high, when they go low, we go high. I love that part.
Right.
And you know, I think that's the direction that we're heading, and I'm really hopeful that we can kind of like rise to that. So thank you very much. I appreciate
it. Oh, it's my pleasure, man. Good luck with it. Let me know anytime.
Yeah, thank you.